A week to make Obama's pivot to Asia real. Today, Wednesday, April 23rd, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Obama begins a week-long trip to Asia, hoping to reassure America's allies that the U.S. stands ready to stem Chinese influence in the region. Some allies aren't so sure.
They look and say, wow, if Obama isn't being tough on Assad in Syria and on Putin, is he really going to back us if the Chinese put the pressure on?
Plus, we hear about the man some call the Mark Zuckerberg of Russia, and our reporter Patrick Cox goes in search of his Chinese name.
Somehow the sound of Cui and Patrick is quite a good fitting. Actually, there's a famous rock singer. His name's Cui Jian.
And that's just one of three names Patrick got.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Ah, the much-vaunted pivot to Asia. President Obama says it's a centerpiece of his foreign policy, and Asia should be the focus over the next few days for him as he visits Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines. But Russia keeps pulling America's attention back to Europe. Today, while Obama talked about security commitments in Asia, the Pentagon was deploying 600 troops to military exercises in Europe to reassure Russia's nervous neighbors. David Gordon was director of policy planning at the State Department for the last 2 years of the Bush administration. He's now with the Eurasia Group.
It's an interesting one for President Obama because when Obama articulated the so-called pivot to Asia, it was about reassuring U.S. friends and allies in the region that the U.S. is really committed to this part of the world. And that was all fine. This was 4 or 5 years ago when they were under a lot of pressure from China and we were in the midst of the downturn caused by the financial crisis. Today, the interesting challenge is that the Asian allies are looking at what Obama has been doing in both the Middle East and vis-a-vis Russia and feeling unsecure. So this notion that you could reassure the Asian allies by announcing this shift of some military resources to Asia and that we're going to concentrate economically on Asia as the most dynamic part of the world hasn't fully reassured the Asians. They look back at the U.S. in the Middle East and the U.S. vis-a-vis Russia and say, wow, if Obama isn't being tough on Assad in Syria and on Putin, is he really going to back us if the Chinese put the pressure on? So it's a big dilemma here. I think the fact of the matter is that the United States can't really fully pivot to Asia.
And more clues to the China-U.S. relationship came out ahead of the trip. The president gave an interview, a written interview, to Japan's Yomiuri newspaper, and they were talking about Japan's claims to the Senkaku Islands disputed. They dispute with China. Specifically, the president wrote, the Senkaku Islands are administered by Japan and therefore fall within the scope of Article 5 of the U.S.-Japan Treaty of Mutual Cooperation and Security. I mean, how significant is that U.S. claim that those are, in fact, Japanese islands?
That's really no change from what the U.S. has been saying from the very beginning of this crisis, that the U.S. position is that we don't take a stance on the sovereignty issues, but these islands are legitimately administered by Japan. Therefore, they're covered under the treaty. But the fact that he was willing to state that again at the beginning of this visit really speaks to the fact that this trip is about reassuring allies.
I mean, it sounds like you're saying nothing short of U.S. credibility is on the line in Asia right now.
I think there's a big challenge to U.S. credibility in Asia right now. I think it actually has somewhat less to do with China, ironically. I think that the China piece in many ways is the easiest one for the president to handle. I think he's going to do that reasonably well. I mean, that was the message that Secretary Hagel sent in Beijing 2 weeks ago. That's the message that the president sent with his interviewed the explicit statement about the status of the islands. So I actually think that piece of it is the most straightforward.
What's the toughest piece of the puzzle?
Well, I think the two much tougher pieces are, one, the economic commercial piece. Is the United States, is the president at the end of the day going to be willing to push a trade agreement that his own caucus is pretty skeptical about, his own party is pretty skeptical about? That's one. And then the second is he going to stand up to Putin in a way that reassures the Asian allies that commitments that an American president is making are real?
David Gordon of the Eurasia Group and former director of policy planning at the State Department speaking with us from Washington. Thank you very much.
Great to be here with you today.
And speaking of Putin and Russia, here's an interesting side note to the crisis in Ukraine. Bloomberg reports that the Kremlin may have used a social media network to monitor Ukrainian activists during the crisis there. Not Facebook, but Russia's equivalent of Facebook, VKontakte, or VK. Mark Millian is global tech editor at Bloomberg News. He says VKontakte is popular not just in Russia, but in neighboring nations as well, like Ukraine.
In Russia and other countries whose languages are more compatible with Russian, this is like the network to be on.
So in terms of numbers, just how popular is it in Russia?
There's at least 240 million people, I think, who are on this network. It's, you know, pales in comparison to Facebook's 1 billion plus globally. But yeah, this is like the Russian website that just about everybody who's on the internet has a profile and connects and messages on.
Tell me a bit about Pavel Durov, the founder of VKontakte. If VKontakte is a Facebook of Russia, does that make Pavel Durov the Mark Zuckerberg of Russia? Does he enjoy the same celebrity?
He does, actually. He's a down-home celebrity in his own country. There are many parallels. Like Zuckerberg, he started it when he was very young. He's kind of this unusual, almost elusive character in the internet scene in Russia. I've met him a couple times. He's a huge movie buff. One of his favorite movies is The Matrix, and he's even kind of aped The Matrix style and the way that he dressed in like a black sort of trench coat, turtleneck type thing.
Wow. You said he's reclusive. He's actually been pushed out of the company, I understand, and left Russia. Can you tell us why he left?
Yeah, he's a libertarian in a country where that's not the most societally accepted way of life. And he's butted heads with some of his investors who have connections to the Kremlin. They have essentially pushed him out of the CEO role.
Back to the possibility that VKontakte has been used or may be used by the Kremlin to monitor protesters in Ukraine. What is the story on that? Is that for real?
It seems to be that they're trying to find a way to sort of get access to this information. And this has really been a huge concern within Russia that, you know, folks with ties to Putin, like Ali Shar Usmanov, who's the lead investor in VK, that they're sort of just in the pockets of the government and that all of their information is going to be handed right over to the Kremlin.
What's the likelihood that the Kremlin would ask VKontakte to hand over information on its users?
I think we'll just have to wait and see. You know, it's entirely possible that they'll, you know, want access to this treasure trove of information that's happening on this social network in the same way that the NSA and other governments put in a request to Facebook. The same sorts of information exists on VK. And as the Russian government comes under pressure for economic reasons, for geopolitical reasons, they'll want to do this same sort of monitoring that many other of the superpowers are doing.
So with Pavel Durov gone, what do you think the future holds for VKontakte? Is it healthy enough that it's kind of on autopilot now?
I think to an extent, it's a pretty developed network. It's been around since 2006. That was just a couple of years after Facebook was founded. So it's got an extremely strong base within Russia. On the flip side, you know, anytime a founder leaves the company, and this is almost a known quantity within Silicon Valley, that the founders sort of have the vision and they have the power to rally the troops and execute within the company. And so without that, bringing in just, you know, a couple billionaires who made their money in completely different industries, I think that's, you know, a sign that there could be some stagnation at VK. And they're not without their own pressures. They were just sued a couple weeks ago by the major music labels based in the U.S. who say that this is just a hotbed of piracy and you're not really doing a whole lot to fix it.
Mark Million, editor of Global Tech for Bloomberg News. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Another country where politics and social media are getting tangled up is Turkey. The country's prime minister, Recep Erdogan, tried to block Twitter recently after two anonymous accounts on the site leaked information that implicated his family and associates in a corruption scandal. Erdogan's move was unsuccessful. Twitter was up and running after only a short interruption. But last week, Twitter did agree to block just the two accounts of users in Turkey. In the meantime, a homegrown alternative to the microblogging platform has taken off in the country. It's called AKPiter, after Erdogan's ruling AK Party, or AKP. Reporter Dalia Mortada in Istanbul has been doing some digging on the new site.
So I got a chance to talk to the founder. His name is Tahsin Çetinkaya. He just decided to test it out. And it basically really caught on amongst AKP supporters for the most part, though he insists it has nothing to do with the AKP, the ruling political party and the party of Prime Minister Erdogan, that this is his project, his individual project. And he says that there are people of all sorts on AKPiter.
Does it have that political kind of alliance with the AKP, though?
Well, when you go to akpiter.com, you'll see a big photo of the Prime Minister Erdogan sort of looking very regal, very similar to old pictures of Atatürk, who's the founder of Turkey. And the name is AKPiter, you know, Twitter, but with the AKP.
Now, how many users does it have so far?
He says there are a million users, and that's really, really a huge amount, just given reading the news reports over the weekend about this service. They were saying there were about 400,000 users. And I think with the surge in media attention, he's saying they've gotten up to a million users.
And generally, who are these users?
For the most part, they look like they're about, you know, younger generation, maybe high school to people in their 20s, though there are people of all sorts. And they generally are people who support the prime minister, who declare their love for the prime minister. You'll see a lot of photos with Erdogan's picture in them. And people who say that they've left Twitter because they don't like the immoral behavior of Twitter, how Twitter allows accounts to stay on that maybe they don't agree with or they think aren't complying with Turkish laws. They've left that and decided to join AKPiter, which is legal and within Turkey's, follows Turkey's laws.
Twitter uses a bird as its logo. AKPiter uses a sheep. Now, that could be seen as self-deprecating, you know, because sheep blindly follow each other. But what is that sheep all about?
Right. So Çetinkaya, the founder of AKPiter, said that, no, the sheep is not meant to be insulting, but it's actually a respected animal in Turkey and a respected animal in Islam. And it's an indication of Turkish values.
What are those values and how do they connect to sheep?
He emphasized the connection with the religion on how the sheep is used as it's a sacrificial animal and it's something that is an honor to sacrifice. And so that was his explanation for it. He also said that the Twitter bird, as it's a symbol of Twitter and as it's an important animal in his mind to people using Twitter, the sheep is that for AKPiter.
So who's the Lady Gaga of AKPiter? I mean, is there a Turkish celebrity we may not know about who's already gotten a huge number of followers?
Actually, the largest number of followers belongs to the AKPiter admins. I haven't seen anything like that quite yet, but who knows? It's a pretty new project. It's only a month old, and it's getting a lot of media coverage in the last few days in Turkey. And there are celebrities that do support the prime minister very strongly, and maybe we could see them on there very soon.
Reporter Dalia Mortada in Istanbul, Turkey. Thanks so much.
Absolutely.
Still ahead, does a recent massive round of drone strikes on targets in Yemen indicate a resurgence of al-Qaeda? On the World from PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon, and by TiVo, delivering cable TV and internet TV together in one searchable and unified viewing experience. Available at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We told you yesterday about the return of beavers to England. Well, the rodents aren't the only species making a comeback in Europe. Many other once locally extinct and endangered animals have rebounded around the continent. Now some conservationists want to go further and reintroduce some creatures that vanished from Europe long, long ago. Christopher Worth explains.
England is full of animals. You've got sheep and barnfuls of cows. But at this farm in the county of Devon in western England, Derek Gow has a herd of cattle like none you've seen before.
This is the only herd of heck cattle in Britain.
Heck cattle are a strong, wild-looking creature with short, shaggy hair and a long, broad set of horns.
You've got this dark animal with a tan line down its back and a white muzzle.
And the thing about heck cattle is it's a breed that's meant to go back in time. They're a creation of two German brothers in the 1930s named Heinz and Lutz Heck, who were fascinated with the wild cattle known as aurochs that once roamed Europe. The auroch went extinct about 400 years ago, but Gow says they were enormous.
When you look at skeletons of aurochs, these are animals that are standing, you know, 5-6 feet of the withers.
You can also see evidence of aurochs in prehistoric cave paintings in Europe. And Gow says the Heck brothers had this idea that although the auroch is extinct, its genes lay hidden in breeds of today's domestic cattle, which are descendants of the ancient animal.
What the brothers did was that before the Second World War, they traveled the world looking for primitive cattle types, and they tried to create an animal that resembled the cave paintings.
It was hardly scientific, and their ideas got caught up in the Nazi fervor of Germany in the 1930s. But today, Gow uses the smaller Heck cattle on his farm to simulate the vanished auroch and the niche it once filled in the landscape, a big grazing animal that helped to shape European forests and grassland.
Heck cattle are probably as near as you're going to get, as far as a visual image goes, of the aurochs that were once here.
Gow says he'd love to see beasts like this roaming the wider English landscape, and he's just part of a growing movement among conservationists called rewilding.
The concept of rewilding is actually very simple.
Frans Scheppers is with Rewilding Europe. It's a Dutch organization that wants to bring back some long-vanished animals, everything from auroch lookalikes to predators that might have preyed on them, and establish large tracts of wild land where they can live.
It's about bringing back species that belong their native species and let them develop into natural numbers and see how we can sort of rebuild these ecosystems back again where we have herbivores, carnivores, and scavengers in modern Europe.
The idea, he says, is to repair the damage done to these ecosystems by humans. Shepherd's group aims to rewild roughly 2.5 million acres across the continent, in Spain and Portugal, in the Carpathian Mountains in Eastern Europe and elsewhere. It's helped by the fact that several species are already coming back on their own. For example, European wolves were nearly hunted to extinction, but Shepherd says a few survived, and the wolf is now returning to parts of France and Germany.
The wolf is coming back big time, but also other species, raptors, vultures, the brown bear, wolverine, bison, all species that are coming back because of strong conservation initiatives.
Some rewilding proponents even suggest introducing elephants and rhinos to mimic the mammoths and woolly rhinoceros that once roamed Europe. But others are far more practical about rewilding. Monica Baum of the Zoological Society of London says there's only so much space for the wildlife that once inhabited the region.
We need to keep in mind that now we're here as well. And quite often this is being a little bit overlooked in some of the rewilding debates. And we need to be realistic about what we can and can't bring back.
At his farm, Derek Gow admits there are limitations. He says he's culled many of the animals from his herd of heck cattle because the breed tends to be very aggressive.
You know, if you went anywhere near them, they would attack you. So I'm afraid those ones are sausages, and what we've got left here is the residue, which is manageable.
But Rewilding Europe is working on a breed of cattle that's a closer match to the ancient auroch. It hopes to establish free-roaming herds of the animal in Europe within the next 2 decades. For The World, I'm Christopher Worth, Devon, England.
We've got pictures of those truly wild-looking heck cattle and images of the extinct aurochs they're meant to emulate at PRI.org. There were violent clashes in Rio de Janeiro last night, just weeks before the city and the rest of Brazil play host to the World Cup soccer tournament. The clashes in Rio were between police and protesters in one of the city's slums, a favela right next door to the famous Copacabana Beach. Residents in that favela were protesting the death of a 25-year-old local dancer who, they say, was beaten by police who thought he was a drug dealer. An official report claimed the dancer died in a fall fleeing a shootout between drug gangs and police. The World's Jason Margolis is joining me now here in the studio. You were in Rio last year, Jason, reporting on so-called pacification efforts in the city's favelas. Lay out, first of all, for us the geography of Rio and the favelas, because if you're in this favela we're talking about, you're just a stone's throw from the tourist areas, right?
Yes, exactly right. So the city of Rio is right on the water, and it's very flat. And then the land juts up dramatically into the sky with these steep hills. It's incredibly beautiful. So now, at the end of the 19th century, soldiers who are coming back from war have nowhere to live in the urban area, so they started building a neighborhood on the steep hillside. It's incredible. They just built a little community there. And for more than a century, this is how Rio develops. The poor people live on the hills. The problem is that these favelas are very haphazard. They don't have modern urban planning. They don't have sanitation, garbage collection, etc. And that's the favelas.
Right. And they draw more poor because they are slums. They attract drug traffickers because there were few cops and they could work with the impunity more or less. Take us into the 21st century. Explain this pacification program, what it's supposed to achieve.
Right. So 21st century comes. Brazil, of course, wins the World Cup and the Olympics, and then they announce this, quote, pacification program. So here's how it works. The authorities say, we're coming into this favela, guns blazing, in 2 days. Drug dealers, you have 2 days to get out of here. And they do this to prevent violence, and it works. And then after the police come, the engineers come in and the social workers, and they make the favela a more livable place.
Where do the drug dealers go?
They just go down to the next favela down the road or a few miles down the road. And I met a young man who was living in one of those favelas, and he was not happy about the pacification program. Here's what he told me.
A pacificação que vem ocorrendo na capital.
We are suffering the impacts of pacification. As police units move into other favelas, drug lords run away, and then they move into our favela.
Now, that said, I followed up with him and I asked, if the police were to come into your favela, would you welcome them? He said, oh, absolutely.
So there seems to be some kind of value, at least with residents. So this violence that's been happening, do you think it's cause for alarm with the World Cup just weeks away now?
Look, the favelas have always been violent places, and firefights and protests like the ones that are happening now happen all the time. When I was there in Rio a year ago, there was a shootout. Nobody outside of Brazil much cared or paid attention. But now that we're a few weeks away from the world coming to Rio, this is getting a lot more global attention. So no, I don't think the pacification program has been a total success. But I don't think it's fair to say it's been a failure either. There are hundreds and hundreds of these favelas throughout Rio. An estimated 1.4 million people live in these favelas. You're never going to have all these places violence-free. But a lot of the favelas, life is a lot better for the residents. It depends on who you ask. It depends on who you are. Has the program worked? Are people going to be safe in the World Cup? You know, it's a difficult question to answer.
The World's Jason Margolis. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
This is The World from Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, will Nepal Sherpas call off the climbing season after a tragic avalanche on Everest? One former guide says no matter what happens, the demand to climb the world's tallest peak isn't going away.
The bottom line is, you know, people don't want to climb the second highest. They want to climb the highest.
Plus, how to find your Chinese name ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. May is considered the ideal month to climb Mount Everest. That's when the weather tends to be best. But there might not be much action on Everest this May because the Sherpas who provide crucial support for climbers may not be there. At a key time of preparation on the mountain, many Sherpas have packed and left Everest Base Camp. Their walkout comes after an avalanche last week killed 13 Sherpas and left another 3 still missing. Jamlin Tenzing Norgay is from the Sherpa community in Nepal. He's a son of Tenzing Norgay, who accompanied Edmund Hillary on his ascent of Everest. So do you think the climbing season is over this year, or should be kind of canceled?
You know, as per our thoughts, you know, and from most of the Sherpas' point of views, we believe that maybe they should call off the climbing season this year as a mark of respect to the people who perished on the mountain, you know, trying to get the Western climbers on the top.
Have you been speaking with any Sherpas back in Nepal who do want to return to the mountain?
No, there's still a debate going on up there. There's a few, one or few groups of Sherpas that want to continue the climb, and there's a majority of them that feel that, no, they should not go up to mark respect for, because they do not want to walk on the same path where their brothers are. You know, some bodies have still not been found. So I just talked to a Sherpa, a good friend of mine, just about a few minutes ago, and they were saying that maybe about 90% of them were thinking about returning, you know, and not going on the expedition anymore for this year, which I think is also, you know, you need to respect their decision and also maybe give Choma Lungma a rest, you know, for a year or so.
Choma Lungma, that's the
local name of Everest. Yeah.
Yeah, local name for Everest. I'm curious, your father was well known as a Sherpa, and you've only climbed Everest once. Why didn't you follow in your father's footsteps?
Well, I did. He climbed it once, and I climbed it once.
Okay.
But he tried to climb this mountain 6 times. And, you know, before in 52, he climbed it just about, he was about 400 meters and had to turn away from the summit because of bad weather. And 53, he got lucky with the weather and, you know, they were able to make it with Edmund Hillary. You know, I don't have any reason to go back to Everest again. You know, I climbed Everest because it's my, you know, it's a family, you know, my father climbed it. I wanted to, you know, be just like him. He was my hero.
What was that experience like for you? I mean, was there one moment that kind of captured what climbing Everest is all about?
I think it's the journey that's important, you know, on this climb. And for me, basically climbing this mountain was more of a pilgrimage, you know, more of paying homage to my late father, since I did not get to know him as well as I wanted to, you know, growing up. It was more of a passion for me to climb this mountain, you know, but unfortunately for most of the other Sherpas that climb the mountain, it's a way of living for them. It's their bread and butter, you know, on the mountain.
I mean, considering the Sherpas are the key to wealthy foreigners who spend tens of thousands of dollars to get up Everest, do you think Sherpas are treated fairly?
Well, yeah, they are treated well on the mountain, but I think, you know, they need to get paid a little bit more. The life insurance they have does not cover much, you know. In case of death on the to one of the Sherpa climbers, you know, the insurance does not pay enough to educate the children and take care of the widows who have no work because they are the sole bread earners of the family. So I think this is one of the issues they have demanded. But the Sherpas risk their lives a lot more than most other climbers. You know, they go up the icefall, the Khumbu icefall, where the accidents took place, up and down this mountain at least about 25, 30 times in one season. Whereas the Western client would probably go up through the icefall about 4 times at the most, 4 or 5 times.
Do you think the Western climbers are really, truly sensitive to the kind of risks the Sherpas put themselves in?
I'm sure they know what the risk is involved because, you know, they don't go on it as much as the Sherpas do. You know, they're carrying all the loads, ferrying everything up. And today, climbing, you know, Everest has become, you know, almost like a overnight mountaineers, you know, people with a lot of money, they throw the money away, you know, to commercial companies giving $70,000, $80,000 and to take them up on the mountain. If they're not there, then there wouldn't be no jobs for the Sherpas, in the, you know, on the other hand also.
Right.
So there's a fine balance they have to have.
What do you think the attraction of Mount Everest continues to be?
Well, I think, see, people ask the same about, you know, why don't people climb K2? But, you know,
K2 is the second highest.
The second highest, yeah. Or Kanchenjunga, third highest. Why don't people climb that as much as they do Everest? And the bottom line is, you know, people don't want to climb the second highest. They want to climb the highest.
Jamlin Tenzing Norgay is a veteran Sherpa. He's also the son of Tenzing Norgay. Thanks very much for speaking with us, Jamlin.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot.
Another walkout, this one at a factory in China. It may affect your next sneaker purchase. Workers at the Yue Wen factory in Dongguan, China, are on strike. I know you've never heard of UN sneakers. That's because there's no such thing. But Nike and Adidas have a lot of their shoes made by UN. The Chinese company is reportedly the largest manufacturer of athletic shoes in the world. And that means a two-week-old work stoppage in Dongguan could affect supply right on down the line. Kevin Sladen is with China Labor Watch, a New York-based group that's keeping an eye on the strike. He says the workers involved are demanding more than just higher pay.
In China, law requires that employers provide social insurance, which is made up of different types of insurance, but the main one is retirement insurance, which is kind of like our Social Security. And workers found that through the past few years, they haven't been given the amount of Social Security, essentially, that the law requires from the factory. And as this spread among workers, many workers, especially ones who had been there for a very long time, were very angered by this, thought it was unfair. And the strike started from there, and it grew.
Who sets the wages and benefits for a factory like UAUN? Is it the factory itself? Is it the Chinese central government? Is it Nike and Adidas?
Every locality in China has a minimum wage that's set by its local government and by the provincial government.
So UAUN has offered to increase benefits for the workers, but apparently 80% of the workers won't take the offer. So how united are these workers? I mean, are there any leaders that you've been in touch with?
We've been in touch with people who are close to negotiations, who have talked to some people representing the management. But workers are very reticent right now to say that they have a distinct leader or set of leaders, because in the past this has led to arrests, harassment, and firings. So workers are smart, and they know that they have to be cautious about talking about who their leaders are. Mm. So there may be, at this point, there may be people who are leading some of the strategy or, you know, the next action. But we don't know exactly who these people are.
Now, earlier this year, there were strikes at Walmart stores in China, at IBM there. Workers were demanding better compensation. Do you think this is the tip of the iceberg of what is a really bigger labor force in China?
The one thing that has come out of this UN strike that's really heartening for labor NGOs or labor activists like us is that it shows workers' awareness and consciousness of their rights is really changing. They're demanding social insurance back pay, which is something that you couldn't imagine a few years ago, because most workers didn't even understand social insurance or the rules associated with it. Now workers are understanding that they have this right to it, and the social insurance can be taken back with them once they leave the factory. They can transfer it to their next employer or back home. And this sort of awareness of their own rights and willingness to defend them is a very heartening thing. So for what this pertains for the future movement, it means that factories and the government are going to have to be more aware of workers' rights and what they're demanding, and they have to meet those demands.
At what point does the Chinese central government say, okay, globalization has been economically really good to us, but we've also got our own citizens that we don't want being abused by domestic or foreign companies?
Well, as with any large bureaucracy, I think there's already people within the Chinese government who have this sort of consciousness. They've already reached this conclusion, but they're fighting others within the bureaucracy. It's obvious from strikes like this and the number of strikes that maybe the increases in minimum wage or other changes in the law or enforcement changes haven't been enough. And that's really one of the biggest problems here, is that despite how strong it is, Chinese labor law is actually the largest problem is enforcement. And that's why workers are striking.
Kevin Sladen, program coordinator of China Labor Watch, speaking with us from New York. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
The hard work of making our clothes and shoes can also be dangerous, deadly even, as was painfully evident last year in Bangladesh with the collapse of the 8-story Rana Plaza factory building. It was the worst ever garment factory disaster. More than 1,000 workers died and over 2,000 were injured. U.S. and European retailers responded by forming groups to push for better safety standards. Tomorrow marks the one-year anniversary of the Rana Plaza disaster. We'll get the latest on efforts to get compensation for the victims and on how the disaster has changed the garment industry. Plus, we'll hear about Fashion Revolution Day. It's a global campaign that asks consumers to examine the clothes they buy and the person who made them.
Do you know how hard they worked? Do you know if their factory was safe?
Rana Plaza, one year on. Tomorrow on The World. In Yemen, over the weekend, a series of drone strikes reportedly killed 55 people. The U.S. has been carrying out strikes against terrorism suspects in Yemen for years, and they've been hugely controversial, especially because they've killed civilians as well as their intended targets. In Yemen, over the weekend, a series of drone strikes reportedly killed 55 people. The U.S. has been carrying out strikes against terrorism suspects in Yemen for years, and they've been hugely controversial, especially because they've killed civilians as well as their intended targets. Gregory Johnson is a fellow at BuzzFeed who's following the story. He's also written extensively about Yemen. Johnson says the latest drone strikes took place over the span of 3 days.
So what we know is that on Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, there were a series of strikes across southern Yemen, basically over three governorates. These strikes involved drones from the U.S. According to recent reports, U.S. special forces were involved in ferrying some Yemeni counterterrorism units down to particular areas in order to carry out raids. There were also airstrikes on a suspected al-Qaeda training camp. So what we've seen is basically this is the most intense, most concentrated, and most sustained period of strikes in Yemen since President Obama first took office.
Right. So you said that these were U.S. drones, but there's been some controversy over who actually called in these strikes, what country did it. So why the misunderstanding?
Right. Well, I mean, one of the things is I think that's just a natural reaction of how reticent the United States has been to talk about some of these covert programs. So one of the things we have going on is that you see very high officials, people like President Obama, who will speak in vague generalities about the U.S. drone war in a place like Yemen. But then you have the CIA, the Pentagon, and other officials who can't speak about the program on the record because it's covert. And so this leads to a lot of confusion. It leads to a lot of uncertainty about what actually took place. What we know for sure is that there were several strikes and a number of people are killed. The U.S. and the Yemeni government is saying anywhere from 55 to 65 of what they call militants were killed. But unfortunately, at this point, because the strikes took place in such a remote region of Yemen, we just have no way of verifying who was actually killed, whether these were the high-value targets, people like the master bomb maker Ibrahim Asiri or the head of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. We just don't know at this point.
Right. So in other words, we don't know whether those 55 people were all high-value targets or they could have all been innocent bystanders, right?
It would be, I think, a stretch to suggest that they were all high-value targets. The number of high-value targets in Yemen that the U.S. has is, I don't think, exceeds 55. But the suggestion, and the Yemeni officials I've talked to, the reporting that's come out from the American side, suggests that the vast majority of these individuals are militants. But then, of course, we have to remember that how the U.S. counts these is any military-age man from the age of 16 up to about 80 is considered a militant until proven otherwise.
And yet the White House has created this impression that al-Qaeda is on the ropes. In his most recent State of the Union speech, Obama said al-Qaeda is a shadow of itself. And yet we see videos of al-Qaeda meeting very brazenly out in the open in Yemen. These strikes have been described as massive and unprecedented. So is Yemen now al-Qaeda's safe haven?
Yeah, the United States, and particularly the United States government, has not done a very good job about talking about where it is in this war against al-Qaeda. There is this tendency to either view al-Qaeda as being almost defeated or al-Qaeda as being ascendant. And I think what the U.S. and what U.S. government officials should be doing is really talking about the changing nature of the threat. So al-Qaeda, what is often considered al-Qaeda central in Afghanistan and Pakistan, that organization has been decimated by drone strikes, by U.S. raids, and by the war in Afghanistan. But what we're seeing is that as the U.S. has done such a good job in those places, al-Qaeda is cropping up in places like Yemen, in Libya, in Iraq, in other places around the Middle East. And so the U.S. really has to deal with a much different threat than it did in the initial years after September 11th. And one of the things I think that worries a number of people is that the U.S. has been bombing Yemen now going on 5 years on a pretty steady basis. But instead of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula growing weaker, growing smaller, having fewer and fewer members, what we see is actually the opposite. The organization itself seems to be growing stronger in spite of all the bombs.
Gregory Johnson, a Michael Hastings Fellow at BuzzFeed. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
You're listening to The World from PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We heard on the show yesterday about how young people in China are choosing English language names for themselves, regular names like Tom and not so regular names like Cinderella. It works the other way, too. Westerners sometimes take Chinese names, often with the help of a Chinese friend. In fact, some expats in China consider having a local name to be as important as having a mobile phone number. The world's language editor Patrick Cox has been learning Chinese for a few years, but he didn't have a Chinese name until he reported this story for us. Now he has three.
Okay, first things first. I should explain why I sought out three Chinese names, not just one. China is full of Westerners with abandoned Chinese names, names that have been tried out on the locals and failed, names that, it turns out, sounded just a bit too weird. So I needed a plan B and a plan C. My first port of call was Boston's Chinatown, where I go once a week to wrestle with the Chinese language.
你好,好久不见。好久不见。你知道好久不见。
Wen Jing Li is my teacher. She grew up in Shanghai, and this is what she came up with when I asked her to give me a Chinese name.
Bo Ke Si.
There's a nice lilt to that, and at the same time, it has a passing resemblance to my English name, which Wen Jing says is all you need. English and Mandarin have such different phonetic systems that it's pointless to try to force one language to sound like the other. You'd end up with one of those weird names. Bo, the first syllable, means plentiful, but it might also imply a certain, shall we say, seniority.
Because you are older than me. So I think...
So this is for an old person? This is a name for an old person?
Because Bo means very, very rich.
I'm glad to hear it.
So it means your age, it means more experience. You went to a lot of places and you got a lot of experience and you have a lot different idea for each country, each language also. So that's why I think... Boys, you are good with Bo.
The second and third syllables, ke and su, mean constantly and thinking or considerate.
Okay, so that's pretty good. We got like rich and plentiful followed by constantly considerate. I like that.
谢谢.
Wen Jing has thrown in some wordplay too. The first two syllables, Bo and ke, pronounced differently, mean podcast. Very clever. She's also included a potential banana skin in the final syllable, su. Pronounce it the wrong way, with the wrong tone, and it sounds like the word for to die.
Yeah, if you pronounce ke si not very clearly, like ke si, then maybe people will think about death. If you pronounce it clearly with the bo together, it will be better.
Well, I think this is very appropriate that you, as my Chinese teacher who wants me to get my tones right, have given me a name where I must get my tones right.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
For name number two, I'm in a restaurant. Chinese pop music plays on a smartphone as a couple of cooks chop beef. This is the Great Mandarin Restaurant in the Boston suburb of Woburn. Tony Huang co-owns the place. He's the father of a friend of mine. He was born and raised in Taiwan, and here's his name for me.
Bai Cui Ke.
Now, on the face of it, this may sound similar to name number one. Bai Cui Ke also sounds a bit like my name. It's also three syllables long, and it has a ke in it, albeit a different one. But that's it. This is a name put together according to totally different principles.
This 19, right? We take a 9. 21, we take 1. The 6 is 6, 8 is 8.
Numbers are big in China. Traditionally, they played a key role in naming. In the old days, parents would visit a fortune teller with the date and time of birth of their child. The fortune teller would then assign a name based on a series of calculations involving, among other things, the number of strokes it takes to write the name in Chinese characters. But for me, Tony didn't need to go to a fortune teller.
Tell me what you did.
I go to the fortune teller website.
The internet. But things quickly get confusing. We count the number of strokes in my Chinese name.
You see, that's 26. The toe is the bad, but...
Wait a minute. You gave me a bad name?
Tony tries to explain, and I try to follow. 26 strokes is good, but there are other stroke calculations in my name that aren't so good. The first two characters are written with 19 strokes, and that matters too.
19 is bad. That's 40%. Oh, good, but 60% bad.
We got to do something about that 19, right?
Yeah, but that's why I ask Freddy how old you are.
Tony wants to know how old I am, because the bad 19 indicates some bad times in my 30s. Once he learns that I'm older than that, well, who cares what my name says about the past? But there's another problem. The last two characters add up to 21.
This one is the relation between you and your boss. It's not smooth, so they have...
It's not smooth. Yeah. My relationship with my boss is not smooth.
Yes.
I'm not going to tell my boss this.
But you can overcome everything and finally success.
So when do I get the success? When does the name tell me that I'm going to get? What age am I going to be? When
up to 49.
So sometime in my 50s or 60s, things are going to be great.
Yes.
Sold. Future happiness guaranteed. I now have two names that I love. I may not need another Chinese name, but I'm getting greedy. I want one. I visit a friend, artist and calligrapher Wenhao Tian. Wenhao also grew up in Taiwan. She now lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. As she shows me around her studio, she tells me about her approach to naming.
I like to find names that is a little bit vague. It makes people wonder and humorous.
So no stroke calculations here, just intuition and the look and sound of the name.
You strike me as a very energetic person, very sporty, and somehow the sound of Cui and Patrick is quite a good fitting.
Cui.
Cui. Actually, there's a famous rock singer. His name's Cui Jian.
How can I resist? Wenhao decides that, like the rock star, my name will have just two characters, two syllables. For the second syllable, she chooses ke.
Ke is doable, okay, achievable.
Okay, so kind of open.
Yeah.
On a sheet of paper, Wenhao paints the characters. As I tell her, Cui Ke sounds good.
It looks good too, right?
I would need a more trained eye to really assess that. I mean, when you say it looks good, I'm going to be taking your word for that.
Oh, I think it looks pretty cool.
Excellent.
It's giddy getting a new name. Giving one, too. I realize now how much thought goes into giving someone a new name. Much more than the other way around, calling someone Lucy or Tony or Lily. As for my Chinese names, I'm not going to pick one, at least for now. I like them all. So American of me. Spoiled for choice. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
You can hear how the three people who gave Patrick his Chinese names got their names at PRI.org. And the music you're hearing now, it's that Chinese rocker, Cui Jian. From the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, ritaallen.org, by the PRI New Voices Fund. Donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, GatesFoundation.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, MacFound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.